Welcome to the Wonder Women Tech Show, where we highlight, celebrate, and amplify global leaders who are creating impact. We humanize our role models and curate a culture of vulnerability and belonging. This is a show designed to innovate, empower, and ignite. I'm your host, Lisa May Brunson. Innovators, it's Lisa May Brunson with the Wonder Women Tech Show. And today's guest is someone who has learned the art of the pivot and has taken data science to the next level. Natasha Potajnik is a recovering academic. She studied theoretical mathematics at Yale and then Columbia, getting her PhD from Columbia in 2016. While there, she performed research in algebraic geometry and taught math to both undergrads and promising high schoolers. Towards the end of her graduate program, Natasha realized that academia wasn't the right fit and started to investigate a career in data science. She eventually participated in a boot camp program for transitioning academics, where she got to design a recommendation system for the Dota 2 video game. There was no going back. Natasha landed a job as a data scientist at Shurison Associates, a data science consulting firm working on an array of projects and products with media publishers and revolutionizing TV advertising. Shurison rebranded to become known, and Natasha transitioned to building and leading a brand new team in media science, focused on scientifically planning, buying, and optimizing advertising for brands. Natasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Yes, I am so excited to go down the rabbit hole of data science, which I personally geek out in, and talk about building media and advertising initiatives that utilize the art of science. But before we dig into that, I'd love to learn more about your childhood and the evolution of your human development. So where did you grow up, and can you share more about your childhood background?
Yes, sure. So I grew up in New York City, and I still live here. So really almost lifelong New Yorker, with a brief break for college where I was in Connecticut. And for me, I wasn't always so into the science part of data science, but I've always been really deeply into the math part. My parents are both in this field-ish. They're both software developers. They met at, weirdly enough, a company named Shearson, but like spelled differently, but also named Shearson, which is a very odd coincidence. I know. And my parents always had that in them. I was actually very actively not wanting to follow in their footsteps as a computer scientist when I was a kid, because I thought of that as like my parents and I wanted to do something different. But I ended up falling in love with math from a very young age, just because it was just really fun, honestly, at my school, the way it was taught. I still remember in third grade, my math teacher would break out the trombone every single week. It was like a Thursday afternoon thing where like we would do some cool math problems, and then he would break out the trombone and play a song. It had nothing to do with math, but it was a fun experience. And then that ended up developing into some really creative math courses that, kudos to my grade school for this, because they really taught math in an innovative way. But I remember like in fifth grade, my math class, instead of working on basic algebra or whatever it is that fifth graders normally do, we would do all these chess problems. Like they would be like written down on a piece of paper with little animated icons and cartoons that the teacher would doodle in, but it would be a chess problem ultimately, all these different chess puzzles. And so that really got me super excited, and I always felt like it was super fun and like a fun game and a fun puzzle. And then it kind of grew from there, that love of math, that love of creativity and problem solving and puzzling.
I mean, you and I had such a drastically different experience, because I absolutely hated math. But I, like, now I'm like thinking, if my teacher brought out a trombone like every Thursday, maybe I would like think about math differently because I sucked at it all my life.
Yeah, no, you know what? I'm so I heard that so much when I was teaching math in grad school. And I'm so thankful, honestly, that my school took a different approach because I probably would have hated it too were it taught the way that it's taught most of the time in this country. It's just very dry, very like write down the notes from the lecture, do the steps that you need to do to solve the problem. And it's not creative. But the ironic thing is math at a high level, like when I was in my PhD program, it's all creative. That's like the entire game, to be creative about solving problems and come up with big new ideas. And unfortunately, it's not taught that way.
Well, I'm going to take your word for it that math is also creative. What are some of the other earlier influences that you feel have shaped you today?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, honestly, the school that I went to, which was first through 12th grade, it was a fairly creative and arts-centered school. It wasn't really science and math was not the focus. And I actually think it was really good for me to be in that environment. Certainly, like, I gravitate towards the quantitative and rigor and logic, and that's what I do for a living now. But I think it was a really important foundation that my upbringing was a little bit more creative in nature, because it's allowed me, A, to have a much bigger appreciation for some of the softer skills, the more creative skills. And it also, I think, helped shape how I think about innovation. You know, like, it was always for me, like, you know, how can you think about problems as open sky problems? How can you go into any problem that you encounter at work or a technical problem? And how can you go in with like a creative mindset, an open mindset, and really solve the problem however it needs to be solved, but not have like the rigor and the rules so much as part of the forcing function. And I think that's something that I saw a lot of my peers in college struggle with, like that creative part, because a lot of folks in STEM, they grow up and they love STEM and they love the quantitative part and they love like coming up with the rule set that they follow every time. But then it doesn't always serve them well, because sometimes you can't just rely on the rule set, you know, you have to discover new ways of doing things. And I think that the fact that I went to such a creative school helped set that foundation for me in what was an important way for really later college, but also even now in my career, because I think now a lot of what I excel in most is tying the like most technical pieces to the business side in a creative way.
I really appreciate that, because it really is like bending the rules a little bit and like allowing for like possibilities to exist, which is like really applicable to pretty much every aspect of life.
Yeah, totally, totally right. I agree. I mean, it's like, it's always just also refreshing for me mentally, from like a mental health perspective, to feel like that freedom of invention when it comes to attacking a problem and not to feel constrained, overly constrained.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to think further on that. So you were one of three women in a challenging math class of 25 people your freshman year at college. What did your educational trajectory look like, and how did you navigate through the challenges you faced along the way?
Yeah, that's an important factoid and also just an important part of the story for me, because that was always a trend ever since I was, you know, sixth grade, seventh grade, even at that young of an age. My school, you know, they would sort the students into different classes based on your math aptitude or your math interest. And being always at the top end of that, those classes were very, very male dominated. And that was a little bit better in grade school than it was in high school. And then it got way worse in college. And I remember actually having a lot of insecurity going to college as a freshman and thinking like, okay, I had this really awesome kind of hippie creative education in first through 12th grade. And is that going to translate in college? Like, am I actually going to be able to survive, you know, the top freshman math class at Yale with all these other kids from all over the country? And so I had a lot of insecurity about that. And something I talked even to my mentor, my math mentor at the time in high school about, and he was trying to like reassure me and tell me that, you know, I would be able to be fine in that environment. I would do fine, but it was still intimidating, and I ended up doing fine. But honestly, it was very intimidating when I first entered that class and the program. And just, it's just like the part of that is just any freshman experience of coming in and being compared all of a sudden to all of these high schoolers from around the country. But another part of that was absolutely the gender component. And it was a very heavily male class right from the beginning. And as people started to drop out because the class was very difficult, it was leaning towards the females who were dropping out more than the males. And that was something that was just the theme even later on in college and in all the math courses I took. You know, it's just it's a low number of women enrolled. And I think like, when you're a teenager, it takes on this, like, in addition to not being awesome that there isn't equal representation and all the problems there, it also takes on a different tone sometimes in those years where it can feel like a teenage boys club, and it can feel very cliquish, and it can feel very isolating if you do not belong to that group. And there's so much ego and which is like tied up in insecurity at that age too. And I think that combined with the gender dynamics, honestly wasn't always awesome. It was something that had to be persevered through. And I consider myself lucky that I just happened to be someone with some amount of inherent innate confidence, deserved or not, I don't know, but it's like a little bit of a blind confidence, you know? And that helped because it helped me not get like too in my head about that, feeling that way and feeling a little bit isolated. That helped. And also I would say like I developed some really strong friendships with some folks in the early years of college that were also in the math group and helped me. Like those friendships we were able to maintain through college, through all the math courses. And I think that also kind of helps. So there's a little bit of a support system.
Yeah, I think that's so important to create that, because you do in these like male dominated environments, whether it's in, you know, school, at home, you know, inside of the workplaces, like you have to kind of find coping mechanisms and skills and counter that with support systems in place. And sometimes that's not possible. So how did you actually cultivate opportunities to find a mentor? And have you had mentors along the way?
Yeah, I feel like I've had important mentors along the way. Certainly had a mentor in high school who was a teacher and also somebody who just mentored me as I was thinking about what it was going to take to apply to college, where would the right fit would be, what I was really good at, you know, all those questions you have at that age. Another really important mentor for me was actually in grad school. When I was in my PhD program, my advisor, he was just awesome. His whole family is awesome. His wife is awesome. She has this awesome feminist blog, which talks about data science and recovering from academia, like myself, and a lot of gender issues. So she was, she and her husband, who's my advisor, they're both a great support system for me, especially given that when I was in my PhD program, I knew probably halfway in that I did not want to go into academia, that my next step was not becoming a professor. I knew I wanted to do something different, something with a little bit more impact. Ultimately, like, I loved math, I still love math, but I don't only love math, and I felt like academia was the kind of profession where you just really had to love that one thing so much that you'd be willing to do it for 8 to 10 hours a day. And that wasn't me. That's never going to be me for any one topic. And my advisor, unlike I know other advisors, really, really supported that and was really there for me when I was thinking about switching industries, switching away from academia. He was supporting me in finishing my thesis. He supported me in thinking about helping me to even find a new job, find a job in a different industry and make that transition. And I just know that often in academia, that's not the case. Often people, professors, you know, they want their progeny to go on and write papers and, you know, be written in the records that they were advised by that professor. That's just sort of the way academia works. But my advisor, there was never a hint of that from him. And he was just always a really, really great mentor. And also someone who brought the fun back in math for me, because I think, like we talked about earlier, I had so much fun in my grade school and high school experience. I went to college and it was a bit less fun, not just because of the gender dynamics, but also because it was all lecture format. It wasn't as creative. It wasn't as dynamic. And he brought that back for me for sure when I was in my PhD program. So in many ways, I see him as a really important mentor at that stage of my life.
Yeah, I mean, I love that you were able to have, I mean, even a family mentor. I mean, how many of us get to have a family behind us that are mentoring us with these unique skills along the way. I mean, that's so important. And to also have, I mean, I think it speaks to how important, you know, men can be, our male counterparts can be in our lives when they show up for us and support our career decisions and our educational growth and career development. So I love that you got to experience that and take that forward.
Yeah, no, 100%.
And as you mentioned, you reached a defining moment where you realized that the academic path you were on wasn't in fact for you. Can you describe what that pivot process looked like? And how did you head towards that different path? Because I know you you would end up doing a boot camp, and you know, what did that process look like for you when you realized like this aha moment of, yeah, this isn't gonna work for me?
Yeah, so for me, the aha moment was probably when I took Russian, which sounds random, but I'll explain. For the PhD program in math, you need to pass a language exam in either Russian, French, or German. And because my dad's Russian, I was like, great, I'll take some Russian. I don't really know the language that well. This will be a good opportunity for me. And I was still in like the thick of grad school. I hadn't made a decision yet about leaving leaving after I graduated from my PhD. But I knew I was not super happy in what I was doing and that trajectory. But when I took this Russian class, honestly, my mood completely turned around. And it wasn't because like I love learning Russian so much. It was just because I got to learn something new. Like I actually was spending time in my day, not just reading math papers, not just talking about the same math problems, but learning something new. And I hadn't actually done that since college. You know, like I hadn't had that diversity in my brain. And all of a sudden I was like turned on again, and I was passionate again about intellectual things. And I was like, oh my God, I'm learning. I'm so interested. And so from there, I was like, okay, I'm going to take programming next. So I took a bunch of computer science classes at Columbia, and I was even more engaged. And that's when I started really getting excited about transitioning. That period of time was my aha moment of like, I definitely can't stay in academia. I definitely need to be doing something with my life where I've got a little more intellectual stimulation and diverse stimulation. And for data science in particular, it was a little bit of a lucky coincidence because my advisor's wife was in data science. She had this data science blog, and we talked about it. She told me about some boot camps that were available for academics that were looking to transition out of academia and move into data science. And it was a great program because it was free if you got in, and they really coached you for 6 to 8 weeks on how to become a data scientist, how to develop the skills, how to present yourself. And I got into the program, and through the course of that program, got to hear about all kinds of companies that came in and pitched what they were doing and were looking to hire. Got to learn about the advertising industry, which of course is the industry I ended up in. Learned about finance, learned about technology. And that was eye-opening too, because I was like, honestly, in academia, you're in a bubble. Like I didn't really know what was going on in the business world. I was just like, just math, just algebraic geometry all the time. And so that was eye-opening. That was awesome. Obviously, I really fell in love with advertising through that process just because it was so cool to me how technical it was, how much data science work there was to do. And then after that program, that's where I met Shearson, the company Shearson. And that's also where I interviewed at Shearson and got the job. And then been at the company ever since, although the company itself has changed a couple times since.
So it took you 8 weeks to fall in love with data science. I mean, that's really inspiring to think about, you know, like if you take a class or you take a boot camp, which there are so many that are free and low cost, that your whole entire life, your whole entire career trajectory will change, and you could fall in love and make an entire living doing something that you never imagined you can do. I mean, 6 to 8 weeks, people, I hope you're listening to that, because that is just so inspiring.
Yeah, I know. It is crazy. Honestly, when you say it like that, it's totally crazy. I've never even thought about it that way before, but you're right. It's totally, you know what? Had I not done that program, I probably would have gone into finance, because that's the number one thing people in math do. And that would have been such a different trajectory for me. And I think I would have been so much less happy. So it really, in many ways, yeah, exactly. It dictated my career.
Well, that's where you say spasiba for for the opportunity.
Exactly.
I had an ex that was Russian, so I know a little bit.
Okay.
So you eventually landed at Shearson Associates, as you mentioned, a data science consulting firm, which has become known, a modern marketing agency, which has been called by Digiday an Iron Man suit made of data science and creativity. I thought that was just such a cool and powerful statement because, one, I'm a huge fan of the MC universe.
Me too.
During the pandemic, I watched the whole entire Marvel universe in chronological order. Yes, I did. not by order of release, but of story. So I was just like, yes, this is, I can get behind this company. But can you break it down for the audience? What is data science?
Yeah, sure. To me, data science is the science of working with data to create business impact. And I think there are a lot of techniques that go into that that are buzzwords like machine learning, predictive modeling, where existing data is being used to predict outcomes, analytics, certainly statistics, certainly some mathematics, some optimization algorithms. But those are all techniques. And ultimately, a data scientist's job is to use those techniques to move the needle on the business. And that's where more creative and strategic skills come into play, because it's about the ability to identify how best to use those techniques to actually drive business outcomes forward. And then also how to communicate what those techniques are actually doing to non-technical stakeholders. So that's like data visualization skills and communication skills. And so to me, that feedback loop and that cycle is really what it means to be a data scientist.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, like I'm such a geek for data and looking at like all the things you can do with it. I mean, you could build solutions, like that's where my hackathon initiatives come. That's why I fell in love with hackathons, because when I founded them, I had no idea what a hackathon was. And then you take these data sets and think through like, how can I like solve this challenge? Like, how can I build something that's actually gonna like tackle this? And so that's, for me, I mean, I wouldn't consider myself a data scientist, but I would say I'm a data geek, and I like to solve challenges using data. So what is it that you personally love about the industry?
There's the data science industry and there's the advertising industry for me, which are like two loves related to my career and job. And for data science, I think it's just very exciting. The whole process is very exciting because of the unknown element. The least fun data science problems for me are the ones that are super well defined, where someone gives you the data set and they're like, okay, predict the likelihood that someone's going to click on the ad. And it's very straightforward, because that's like, you know, that's fairly simple. And there's only so much you're going to really learn that's going to challenge your way of thinking. The most fun parts about data science for me are when it's more open-ended, you're given a data set and you're diving into it and you just explore and you learn things that challenge the way your ways of thinking and your assumptions about the way a problem works or the way an ecosystem works. And that's exciting. There's just that feeling of science there where you're like, oh, like, look at this angle. And I didn't know that people are more likely to do this if they see this first. And that part of it is very exploratory and fun and feels like you're treading new ground. And then the other part that is very personally satisfying to me, and I don't get to do quite as much of this now since I'm more of a leader and a manager and a mentor, but as an individual contributor back when I was doing more of that, one thing that's always really satisfying is seeing your project come to fruition, wrap up, have the impact, actually be deployed, be useful to people. And I think that has been was such a joy for me coming from academia too, where everything you do is so esoteric and there's like a 3-year review cycle and papers and nothing ever has that
theories.
Immediate impact. exactly. So that, for the data science industry, that's really what I... So a couple of things that I really love.
Yeah, because when you think about it, like, science is experimentation. So you get to play and see what happens from that.
Exactly.
So you lead the media science team, which is made up of almost 100 inclusive data scientists, engineers, data analysts, media strategists, and media specialists. So what kind of magic are you all producing in the known multiverse?
I love that description, known multiverse. Oh my God, I love that. All right, that's going to be part of my new marketing materials. Now, you know why I love that, though? Because it's also like we are such an integrated team. The company is so integrated, and my team is also so integrated. We have such a diverse group of people in terms of skill set, right? We got data scientists, we have analysts, but then we have totally non-technical folks. We have media strategists. We have people who are experts at buying and negotiating at advertising inventory. And that is part of our magic, if I'm being honest, is that magic of combining the different diverse skill sets into one place, bringing all these people who are best in class at what they do into one room together to create and plan and optimize the most amazing campaign. And that's really a big part of our magic and secret sauce. And then another big part of the magic is investing in technology and really being scientifically forward with everything that we do. So always asking for any advertising problem we get posed to, by our clients, we always ask, what is the rationale behind that question? And how can we strategically and scientifically answer it? And it doesn't mean that sometimes there just isn't enough data. There's often not enough data to solve a problem. So we won't always have a firm foundation, but we can still be rational and evidence-based and rigorous in how we choose to answer. And I think that's a big part of how we approach our clients' challenges. And that's the science first, evidence-based mentality that is a common thread in all the people on my team, even the people who aren't coming from a technical background or coding every day.
Yeah, I love the integration of all of that, like cross-sectionality of expertise and experience. I mean, that's just so, that's my jam. I used to work in the marketing and branding world before I launched Wonder Woman Tech and everything I'm doing now. And all of those skills, that creativity, all of that I get to bring to everyday life. So I had the opportunity to visit your website, known.is. I love that. I was geeking out on that. I have to say, like, your website is totally awesome. You all are working with the who's who of entertainment and media. I mean, I literally was just jaw-dropping. I love how interactive the site is. So, you know, I do judge a book by its cover. You know, like, there are a lot of, I mean, you know, you probably know this. Like, there's so many marketing and branding agencies that are dry. And you go to their website and I'm like, how are they supposed to design an innovative campaign? Like, I don't get it. But I get it when I go to your website and I'm like, yeah, they know what they're talking about.
I love that. Thank you.
Like, oh, I can totally work there one day. So how much do you love your job? And what are your plans for continuing to develop your leadership role there?
Yeah, great questions. I love my job. I really love the culture that we've been able to grow at Known. And honestly, it's a culture that we inherited from the company we used to be, Shearson, and also the companies that we merged with when we became Known. We have such a curiosity-loving, fearless culture that really is always about asking, is there a better way? Is there a more modern approach to this question? Are we really... are we answering it in the best possible way we can? And because we have that culture, we're always striving for a very, very high bar. And we've hired people who are striving for that high bar. And it's really inspiring to be working with those people every day, especially because we're integrated, especially because we don't just do data science. It's because we do creative too, and we do strategy as well. And so I get to work with all these people who are best in class at different things that I'm not best in class in. And I think that's a learning experience every day. So I really, really love that. In terms of my leadership role, I consider myself lucky to have a team that has grown so immensely in the past few years, which means that I've been able to learn a ton and I've been able to be part of a high growth organization. You know, I started this team, the media buying team, a few years ago now. And when we started, it was just a handful of people, you know, 3-4 people, because it was a brand new capability for the company. And now to be at almost 100 has been a wild ride. And I've learned so much. And it's been really, really fun because, like, you know, probably give guess from my background, I'm just somebody who, like, I get antsy when things are too stagnant. Like I like change. I like growth, even when it's challenging, which it, you know, of course it has been to grow a team so quickly, but I like that and I thrive in that. And we're still on that growth path and that growth moment right now. So I feel really optimistic and excited about the new challenges ahead of us as we try to grow the business even more this year, grow the team even more. I anticipate learning a lot more and growing a lot more personally and just being continuing to be really intellectually challenged, which is my sweet spot, I think.
Yeah. Do you have a focus for diversity and inclusion in your growth strategies?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up, because that has been something that is super top of mind for me in the past 6 months as we've gotten a lot bigger. You know, when you're small, and I'm sure a lot of teams and companies have used this excuse before, when you're small, you're like, okay, well, we have six people, there's only one woman, but you know, we're small, so it's a small sample size. As you start getting larger, you start realizing systemic issues that you may have when it comes to hiring, or just systemic issues that an industry might have when it comes to talent. And we've certainly faced that challenge and are making much stronger commitments this year, me personally on my team, but also the company-wide, to continue closing the gap in places where there are gaps with certain groups, and just building a team that is more representative. And it's especially important because we're in advertising. You know, most of the campaigns we run are for all people. They're not for one group of people, not one demographic. And it's really, really important that if we're doing that work and we're making such important decisions, at least in the advertising space, that we are ourselves well-rounded and we are ourselves diverse. So that's something I'm absolutely committed to. And honestly, we have a lot more data now to be smarter with decision-making, because we've hired a bunch of people, we've interviewed a bunch of people, we have a lot of data about where our weaknesses might be and how to get better.
I really love that you're able to like turn the dial back and say like, okay, we know how to collect data, we know how to analyze it, we know how to build solutions, like let's actually look at this internal, you know, practice of hiring and see how we can do better. More companies should do that.
Totally. I know. And it's actually such an interesting data problem too. It is so interesting to look at some of that data on your own processes. You know, you turn all those skills on yourself and you examine like, what can we do
I
better
love that.
Here?
So Natasha, what are you known for?
Oh my God. Hard question. Okay. On the fun side, I think I'm known for karaoke. I'm a big karaoke fan, honestly, and so much so that even at company events, I've been known to dominate the mic when there's karaoke available. Yeah, that's on the fun side. On the not as fun side, but like the more serious career side, what am I known for? I hope I'm known for continuing to push the boundaries of what's possible, whether that be business challenges, data science challenges, advertising challenges. I derive a lot of energy from innovation and hopefully inspiring innovation, collaborating on innovation. And I think there's a lot of work left to do there, but that is what I hope to be known for. I'll put it that way.
Oh my gosh, I love that. We are going to take a break for today's Pioneering Women segment.
Today's pioneering woman is Edith Clark. Edith Clark was a pioneer in electrical engineering and was the first professionally employed female electrical engineer and the first full-time female professor of electrical engineering in the United States. Clark studied mathematics and astronomy and graduated from Vassar College with Pi Beta Kappa honors. She then enrolled as a civil engineering student at the University of Wisconsin and took a summer job as a computer assistant to AT&T research engineer, Dr. George Campbell. Edith's work impressed him so much, she stayed on at AT&T to train a group of human computers. She left to enroll in the EEC program at MIT and became the first woman to earn an MSc degree from that department. Edith then worked for General Electric, where she filed a patent for their graphical calculator, and later took a position as a professor of physics at the Constantinople Women's College, becoming the first woman to present a paper before the American Institute of Electrical Engineers. Thank you for your pioneering contributions, Edith Clark.
Hello, innovators. We are back talking with Natasha Potajnik about how to pivot and create opportunities in 6 weeks or eight for a new career path. I have definitely enjoyed learning about data science and its impact on our everyday life and in media and advertising. This has just been such an awesome conversation, Natasha. Your biggest hope is that we as a society figure out how to stop dissuading women from getting into STEM at such a young age. What do you feel some of the building blocks towards that change will be?
Ooh, that is a hard question. But yes, that is absolutely something that I feel like is an enormous barrier for us now. And unfortunately, the problem is so deeply systemic, I feel sometimes. Like it's in, and this has been talked about a ton in the media, but it's about the toys that we're selling to children. It's about the media that children are exposed to. It's even about the advertising. You know, if you think about like are we advertising more STEM like exploration kits to TV show cartoons that index highly on boys instead of girls? Like, in that sense, it is so deeply systemic that I think the best way that we can even start to solve the problem is to talk about it and to be loud about it and to just impact at least some of the right thinking so that people who are making these decisions in all of these places are starting to consider the impact that these decisions can have on someone's entire life, really. And then I think it's also about, frankly, like educators and the people on the front lines who are working with these children, who are teaching children and mentoring children. I think there's a big thing there where there's usually a moment where someone just decides that they're not good at something or that something is not for them. Especially when you're a kid, you're shaping a lot of who you are, right? As you grow up, you make decisions about what you like and what you don't like. And that's where it starts. You know, that's where you'll hear stories about this. I have peers whose children are going through this. They're, you know, it's like you'll have a 5-year-old girl who comes home and decides, I'm terrible at math. It's like, how could you know you're terrible at math? You're only 5 and there's so much more to math than what you've probably experienced in, like, you know, however short many months and years you've been alive and in math classes. But I think that grows deep. You know, you make that decision young and it sticks with you. And I've seen that, like, I've seen that in the craziest ways. I remember I taught this class in grad school for adults who were looking to brush up on their math so that they could go on to med school or to go into a program where they needed basic math. And everyone in that class thought they were terrible at math, right? They were there, they had to be in that class because they basically didn't learn the things that they were, quote unquote, supposed to learn in high school. And it was interesting because a couple people I had in that class, and I remember them, were so convinced they were terrible at math, happened to both be women, and they had just this deep complex that they were terrible at it. But they were so good. They had so much innate talent. Like I would work through all these creative problems with them, and they had so much intuition. They had all of that like deep math intuition that is so highly valued later on in a math career when you're in your PhD program. Like, oh, how much intuition do you have? Like, what is your innate ability to understand these problems? And these two women had it. They just were convinced that they were terrible at math because someone told them so, or they had a bad experience when they were children. And that was like a really big aha moment for me, because here is like two adults who were, I was like, hopefully hoping them completely change the script on how they saw themselves and their own inner narratives about their ability to do STEM. So I've seen it firsthand, and that's just a sad thing because, you know, that's like entire careers wiped away because of some silly stuff that may have happened to you when you're a kid. That just ends up being really foundational.
Well, I lived that story because I was exactly that kid where, you know, I was bullied in school and teachers didn't really support my, you know, interests, and math was just like hard, quote unquote. And it just wasn't something that was cultivated in me. And it's funny because my dad, like when I was in the 8th grade, was like, you know, because I was getting F's and D's in math, but I was brilliant at everything else. Right. Like and so my dad was like, well, if you get, you know, at least a B, I'm going to get you a bike. And I got a B. I never got the bike, but That was another lesson. But it's so true though. Like when you are exposed and like you have that positive, you know, reinforcement and that visibility around other women and other diverse humans being in these industries or having fun, you know, breaking up the trombone if they have to, but like just really creating an environment that is positive, right? And I do agree with you that, you know, having those conversations and seeing more representation and also like taking the time to nurture individuals who just need a little bit extra care like I did and might learn differently as well.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So we've all experienced quite a lot of heaviness over the last 2 years. You mentioned unwinding with karaoke. So I'd love to know like what other ways you have that you unwind. And then also, what is your favorite karaoke song?
Oh my God. I have so many favorite karaoke songs. It changes over time. I have been itching to do the 10-minute version of All Too Well by Taylor Swift.
You just said 10-minute version. Like, I already now know that, yes, she is that girl that takes the mic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Historically, I've loved Total Eclipse of the Heart. And that's honestly been a big classic for me. And then also... what is the Meatloaf and Celine Dion song that's like...
I know it, but I'm totally...
Yeah, it's like if you... Anyway, I'm not going to recite the lyrics, but that song.
I was going to say, sing some bars for us. We actually had a guest sing for us one time. It was so funny.
Oh my God. Not brave enough without a drinking man.
I hear you. I'm actually a karaoke person. I sing... I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor. I sing a lot of Adele. Nice. and Deborah Cox and Mary J. Blige and Bonnie Raitt. I love Bonnie Raitt. For those of you that don't know, she's an epic country singer. But yeah, I also like to sing. So maybe one of these days,
awesome.
Natasha, when we can safely get together. Exactly. Was there ever a moment in your life where you just felt like you wanted to give up? And if so, how did you get through that experience?
Yeah. Honestly, a moment like that for me was in grad school before I realized that academia wasn't for me. I very much was going through this existential crisis where I loved math and I knew I loved math. It was so dear to me for so many years, but the program clearly wasn't working for me. Like I just wasn't happy. And it took a really long time to come to terms with that for me because it felt like a failure and it felt like something that didn't match my own perception of myself and who I was and this person who loved math. And I didn't get it. I didn't get like why I wasn't happier, why I wasn't more passionate about what I was doing. And it was just the point where I was wondering, like, should I give up on this program? What will I do if I could totally give up on it? And I was just lost, honestly. And it was really like, I wish I had some story about how I really like figured it out myself and was able to persevere. But I honestly think it was kind of random. I think it was the fact that I took that Russian class that kind of forced me to open my mind to the problem, because I was getting so in my head about it. And so like, you can imagine being a PhD student, you don't really get exposed to too much. Like I would do work often in my own apartment, in my living room every day, just sitting there reading papers and trying to come up with ideas, scribbling notes on a piece of paper. And then, or, you know, more adventurous, I would go into the grad school office and do that exact same thing. So my life felt very closed off and like very kind of like it was easy to spiral. And so I was definitely spiraling. And I think I got lucky to have the opportunity to start force my brain to think about something new, which let me really zoom out. And I think the zoom out technique has been something that's helped me in other moments where I felt like on the cusp of failing or giving up. It's just like, okay, hold up. Let's just zoom out for a second and like take myself away from these emotions in the moment and assess what is really going on, and also just take a beat. And sometimes it's like you get so upset about something that's happening in the moment, but if you zoom out, you realize maybe it's not that important, or maybe not all parts of it are as important as you're feeling. And that technique has been helpful for me many times, frankly, in my career.
It is such a golden nugget, Natasha, right there. You know, well, first of all, if like being adventurous is doing the same thing just in another building, you definitely need to go zoom out, you know, like, I mean, I recently had to do that myself, you know, with Wonder Woman Tech. I just was like, you know, 8 years last year, I reached a pivotal moment where I was like, I don't think I can do this the same way we've been doing this. And so I love that phrase, you know, that taking a beat, zooming out and reassessing and reevaluating, and that can literally make or break the next chapter of your life. So I'm so grateful to you for sharing that. And at Wonder Woman Tech, we are passionate about vulnerability as a superpower. So we ask all of our guests, can you share something with us that you have never shared with anyone before?
Yes. So I don't know if this is the most vulnerable moment, but maybe it's really surprising. And maybe in a way it's vulnerable. When I was a teenager, I was really, really, I would say upset, passionate, but also obsessed with all things related to China. I like was traveling to China every summer. I was there for months. I got super into like potentially being a journalist in China, getting involved in politics there. And I felt like that, honestly, there's a good chance that my entire career life would have been that. And it just happened to not, because I just happened to not get one of the internships that I wanted there, and it ended up pushing me a little bit more towards math. But I was very close to having an extremely different career that probably had very little to do with STEM, and I wouldn't have been on this podcast in the first place. But that's something that I don't think, nobody knows that about me, or most people don't know that about me, and most people at my jobs really don't even know that I speak Chinese, and I had that level of passion and excitement for that.
I mean, you heard it here first, y'all. Natasha can speak Chinese. That is really, I mean, imagine like how much, you know, secrets and like other lives that we live.
Oh, I have so many weird I know. I have so many weird stories too for another podcast.
I love
podcast.
That one. We'll definitely have to revisit them. So you've had an incredible journey of pivots, it sounds like, and navigating through heavily male-dominated environments, and you have carved your own path. So if you had to do it all over again, would you take the easy road or the road less traveled, and why?
Definitely the road less traveled. Like I said, I feel like I get so bored so easily. I consider myself, what I say sometimes is I'm intellectually fickle. Like when something is too easy or too the same for too long, I'm just like freaking out. My brain starts going in a million places. I'm like, I'm getting stuck. My life is only so short. Why am I doing this thing over and over again? So I would say easy is not my path. I would have, not that I would have done everything that I have done it exactly the same way, but I'm glad that it was difficult in places. I'm glad that it required pivots, because I think it's well suited ultimately for what makes me happy.
Oh, Natasha, it has been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, innovators. Make sure you give us a like and share the podcast with your network. We'll see you next week, when we take on the world one more time.